Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us on the path to where evolution is taking us. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems together rather than defend positions. Today we're going to face the elephant and the donkey in the living room, the identical issue we all face that trumps, no pun intended, all of the identity issues. And that is the cataclysmic climate change due to human, and some might also suggest inhuman, activity. No matter how we identify ourselves and no matter what our positions are on the culture wars wedge-type issues, we cannot exist outside the web of life. Those issues become irrelevant rather quickly. Or as Swami says, if we lose the earth, there goes the GDP. There's bad news, and there's good news. The bad news is our species is on a disaster path toward extinction. The good news is we might finally be ready, willing, and able to face the bad news. On today's show, we have opened our mics to two mics, longtime climate activist Michael Mielke and an evangelical Christian minister, Michael Dodd, who has written a deep, insightful, and witty book, Thank God for Evolution. Together, they're going to help us address three questions about climate change. What so what, and now what? We'll begin our first segment with climate activist Michael Mielke, who's been a voice, I would call it a voice in the bee wilderness, for many years. And he's just published a really clear and sober mini book called Delusions and Contradictions. And I think you can tell from the title where he might be going with that book. And then in the second segment, we'll hear from Michael Dowd, who offers a new this-worldly cosmology and suggests that we are the saviors we've been waiting for. Then in the final segment, both mics will have the mic as we look at a new context for activism and the most effective actions we can take now. So first, Michael Mielke, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you.
Very good. So we're just going to jump right in. What is your assessment of the current, we call it, situation? And don't be afraid to dive right into the cesspool. My listeners are used to it.
So we'll start with the way you've outlined it, Steve, and you've said, okay, first of all, what so? And what so is we face two looming and present crises. One is the climate crisis. The second is ecological overshoot. And we're focusing today on the climate crisis. And in terms of what so, the critical information for Wiki Politiki, I think, is to communicate to our side, the side that understands there's a problem, and that's the vast majority of Americans out there. They know that in climate there's a problem. But in terms of what's so, what is actually the problem? Because we live in a world that's a world of virtual reality, not necessarily reality itself. So there is a world, and we see online and in broadcast and in the media, many, many, many things that we could do, we should do, we might do, we hope we can do. But when it comes to climate, it's not what we might, could, should, or possibly may do in terms of renewables and all of the other solutions to excessive carbon dioxide from fossil fuels, but it's actually in the real world what we are doing. So in terms of what's so, we know what we could do, might do, should do, but we're not doing it. Just some specifics. So now, currently across the world, we are continuing to increase our carbon dioxide and fossil fuel use. We're continuing to add to global warming. So just three things. I mean, that's what's really going on. The world, therefore, is operating on the wrong assumptions. Our side, the side that cares, for example, I said three things. One, we have across our side, the caring side, the idea that local, city, state actions can somehow fill the gap of what's missing in this administration, that we can actually accomplish what we need to accomplish if we can get local people and state people to go somehow for zero carbon. But if you look at that, and you look at it from the global perspective, what the UN emissions gap report says, what the climate tracking systems say, is that in reality, right now, we are 4,500 pounds more in carbon dioxide pollution per person each year than what would be necessary to hold to 2 degrees. In other words, we know we could do a lot better, and we're hoping that if we did something at the city local level, it might work to fill in the gap. But the truth is, it won't, and it can't. That's number one. So what's happening in terms of renewables and what's happening to low carbon energy and where are we getting and what are we leading to? And if you look at across the media and across the internet, you see, well, we could do all of these different things. I mean, Paul Hawken has a great book on drawdown, 100 things we could do. Now, the fact that we're not doing any of them is not the point. The solutions exist, but what are we doing of those solutions? And the answer is we're doing none of them. So we're on track, not for the Paris Agreement, which is 2 degrees, centigrade we have promised in the world to hold to, but we're on track for 7.8 degrees Fahrenheit. This is not my opinion. This is what the UN emissions gap report says. This is what Carbon Tracker says. This is even with the best efforts from local, city, and state actions. So right now, the third thing is we've only, with all the nations of the world, put forth one-third in our intended contributions. That's at the world level what's called on. And that's national intended contributions. And only one-third of what's necessary to hold below catastrophe. Again, this is not an opinion I'm talking about. This is what the world has offered. You can see this, again, in the emissions gap report. So I give you a chance to ask a question here, but what's critical is we live in a world of virtual reality. If you look at virtual reality, you look at things on the internet, you say, okay, here are a lot of things we could do or should do. We could have a lot more renewable, but what are we really doing? So if we ask what we are really doing, not what we should have, could have, would have done, we are headed for disaster.
That's well, it certainly seems that way, and you know, in your book on delusions, et cetera, you're suggesting that even the people who are very much involved, as you mentioned, Paul Hawkins' book, and I know a lot of people are using Drawdown as a template for how they can act. What is it about that approach that that is ineffective or not enough?
The whole thing about that approach, and it relates to all of the other things that I mentioned, it's the difference between reality. That is what we're actually doing, which, as I said, we're actually increasing fossil fuel consumption. And it's true here, even in our transportation sector. You know, we have increased our use of fossil fuels for more gasoline, more driving, more international flights, et cetera. So rather than what we could do, and drawdown speaks to actually using less carbon dioxide, using less fossil fuels, or drawing it down, it's what are we really doing? So we have to live in what's actually happening, not what we wish would be happening. And at the actual side, we're producing catastrophe. What we could wish for is some miracle. I mean, we saw this in 2010 when Bill Gates in February of that year, still on a TED Talk, you can see it, it's wonderful. He says, we need to get to zero carbon energy. This is 2010. He concludes his TED Talk that we can actually do it. He says, we need energy miracles. He's investing himself in fourth generation nuclear. And he says, we can do this. But the truth, here we have 8.5 years later, which is an enormous amount of fossil fuels that have been burnt in this time, increasing. Do we have any energy miracles? No. Are they on the horizon? No. Have they been demonstrated? No. Do we have negative emissions technologies? No. Do we have proven carbon capture or sequestration? No. But you have an enormous amount of media coverage and studies saying we could do this or we could do that or we need to prove this or this is coming online sometime soon. But all of that is the virtual reality part. It's what are we actually doing? And what we're not doing is reducing our consumption. And that's the only thing that can get to saving us. And that's what we don't want to do because we would prefer miracles or wishes to reality.
So what you're saying is that this is a system of massive denial combined with the momentum, with the inertia of a machinery that is chugging along and doesn't know how to stop itself or change direction. So obviously you're going to offer a direction. What is the direction forward that will move us from this consumption model that we have right now to slow the train down and help us change direction? How do you see that coming about?
Well, I think there are two things, you know, two key pieces in dealing with reality. First, who sets the strategy and provides the funding for reducing fossil fuels on our side? And the answer to that's simple. It's philanthropy. You know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars a year funding these grassroots groups or funding Big Green or funding green groups who are trying to fight at the various levels to oppose this administration and oppose increasing or consuming fossil fuels. So that's the entity who's funding the strategy on our side. And philanthropy itself is operating on the wrong assumptions. Two critical points here. One is, if you read the internal strategy documents, again, this is not my opinion. I'm not stating opinion. I'm stating from their own internal strategic document. They say we need an 80% reduction in our energy by 2050. Well, that's way off. We have to be far beyond that by 2030. And that, again, you see that in the emissions gap report. You see that in Carbon Tracker. So the entity which is funding our solution attempts is operating from the wrong basic assumption, which is that we have a hell of a lot more time than we actually have. We can take it easy. We can tweak the current system. Simply not true. Okay. Continuing on that, number one, operating on the wrong assumptions, all of that in what philanthropy is assuming in setting our strategy assumes that we're going to find and build and implement negative emissions technologies. Again, the miracles that basically were called for and talked about by Bill Gates 8.5 years ago, none of which have shown up. And if they did show up somehow in the next couple of years, how long would it take for us to test them, prove them, make them economic, and then distribute them? So we're betting on miracles even with the wrong assumption. So that's the first thing. Philanthropy, our side, our strategists, our funders, because obviously government and business is not providing money for us to work toward reducing. So philanthropy is the entity that's funding this. They're operating from the wrong assumptions. Secondly, philanthropy itself, in operating from the wrong assumptions, is not providing the funding for what we need. Because if they're operating from the wrong assumptions, they're funding these local, city, state actions, and that's supposed to fill in for Trump. There's a big conference coming up in September in San Francisco, and it's all focused on what Michael Bloomberg and Jerry Brown, the former mayor of New York and the current governor of California. This is the great effort for them to do with cities and states what is not being done by the federal government, by the administration. And it's very simple to show that best effort, everything that they could do, will not make any consequent difference to lowering the emission gap or get us anywhere close to that. So they're not operating only on the wrong assumptions. They're operating to fund the wrong strategies and tactics. Therefore, the answer is for philanthropy to be called to give us a warning for a different operational functioning or modality. That is, we need to warn people. We're not going to tweak it, gradually change something, do it some 10 years from now. It's we're in an emergency now, and we need to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels as immediately as possible. And that is the answer. We've got to get philanthropy, which is the only entity funding help, to use the right strategy and the right tactics and warn people of how dangerous and close to catastrophe we really are.
Amen.
Steve.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, hi, Steve Behrman back with our two mics on WikiPolitiki, talking about climate change, talking about spiritual climate change as well. Sounds like we need a miracle, and you know what? There is a template for miracles. It's called spontaneous remission, and we've heard the stories about people who have miraculously cured themselves of life-threatening illnesses even after they've been given the death sentence. And Luis Mel Medrano, who is a MD, actually wrote a book called Coyote Medicine, where he talks about people who've had these anomalous healings. And what he said is that in almost every case of people who have healed themselves of these life-threatening conditions, there was what he calls a change of story. So if we want a spontaneous remission in this worldwide story that we've created for ourselves about what human endeavor is about, what economics and ecologics and religion is about, we have to create a spontaneous remissioning to change our mission. And our guest in this segment is Michael Dowd. He's the author of Thank God for Evolution. And he offers a novel and compelling this-worldly theology that is synonymous with ecology. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to talk with you. So why don't we jump right in? What is your theology in relation to our current situation as we're on the cusp of perhaps weaving ourselves out of the web of life?
Well, first, before I even answer that or respond to that, as you know, my wife, Connie Barlow, and I have been living on the road for 17 years now, traveling North America, speaking to about 2,500 groups, secular and religious, basically where science, inspiration, and sustainability intersect. And of the thousands of men that I've interacted with, women too, obviously, but of the thousands of men I've interacted with and feel a sense of colleagueship and brotherhood and just shared partnership in terms of mission legacy work, you and Michael Mielke are right up in the top five. And so it's a joy for me to be on this conversation with you and with Michael Mielke. I just amen everything he said in his previous segment. So to your question, for me, ecology has to be the heart of theology. In fact, I'd say it more strongly, that any theology 100 years from now that doesn't have ecology, that is the interdisciplinary sciences of right relationship to time and nature, God's time and God's nature, is a theology that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will condemn us for. So we're seeing the greening of religion. We're seeing the greening of everything. But the greening of religion is especially important because, as Teddy Goldsmith famously talked about, he's the author of The Way, An Ecological Worldview. He was the founder and the editor for 35 years of The Ecologist magazine. And he was a tireless advocate of right relationship to primary reality, that is, right relationship to the air, water, soil, and life upon which we depend. And the truth of the matter is we have 97% of human history that we lived like that. To use mythic language in my Christian tradition, that was our time in the garden with God. That is, we walked intimately with reality. We walked in a mutually enhancing relationship with primary reality. That is, we could live for thousands of years, and we did for actually hundreds of thousands of years, without diminishing or destroying or degrading what we were dependent upon for our own existence. And we know how to do that. We have lots of anthropological evidence of how to do that. And it turns out that religion played the essential role in every sustainable society, every stable society for which we have evidence. In fact, Teddy Goldsmith, wrote an entire book called The Stable Society just on this. And that is that religion's role above everything else, is to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present. So that living in the present is always done in a way that is a blessing rather than a curse to the future. To use Christian religious language, that the future is always Lord. And the interesting thing is, when you demythologize religion, when you demythologize any religious tradition, and then reinterpret it in a this-world realistic way, in a way that's compellingly real in an undeniable way, it becomes clear that religion can play, in fact, not only can, must play the essential role, which is to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present. We don't have that situation in the current environment because religion has basically been asleep at the wheel for the last 500 years. In fact, that metaphor isn't quite strong enough. I used to say religion was asleep at the wheel because of our mechanistic worldview, that is, thinking of God as a clockmaker outside a clockwork God. But the truth of the matter is that half of religion is gagged and tied in the trunk, and the other half of religion is in the back seat cheering on the psychopathic politicians that are driving us over the cliff. So it's a pathetic situation, but it's totally understandable when we realize that idolatry, which is a very religious term that most people, most of your listeners, will have no sense of what the hell I'm even meaning by that term. But idolatry isn't bowing down to statues, and it's not believing in the wrong God. Idolatry is simply human-centeredness. Idolatry is anthropocentrism. It's when we interpret success in human-centered terms. So gross domestic product or gross national product is a human-centered measure of success. We need to measure success. In fact, the only sustainable measure of success, the only God-glorifying, to use religious language, and again, what I'm meaning by God is basically the universe with a heart and a voice, plus whatever you want to believe about the transcendent, that's fine, but it's got to include the universe. Otherwise, we're not talking about reality. So what is reality telling us? What is time and nature telling us? Well, it turns out time and nature are telling us some very profound things about what we need to do to live in right relationship to reality. But we're not going to be present to that divine revelation through evidence, the evidential revelation, that is, evidence as modern-day scripture. We're not going to be present to that if we're valuing old men and old books as our primary source of authority. So that's why I'm a passionate advocate of what I call the evidential reformation, that is, evidence as modern-day scripture, facts as God's native tongue, that is, trends, scientific trends of the way God is shouting to us through bullhorns. And basically, it's very clear. Religion has a vital role to play, and the main purpose of religion is to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present. And it's done that historically through four mechanisms. One is to ensuring that primary reality is always treated as primary. That is, the living world, the biosphere, the ecosphere is always treated as primary, and humans are derivative. We emerge out of the body of life. So that's first, to use religious language, God first. The second is the seventh generation. That is, every sustainable society allowed the imaginary presence of the future to guide the decisions of the present. And the fact that we don't do that isn't just a bad idea, it's evil. Good people become evil when they allow the present and the present's needs and wants and wishes and hungers and addictions and thirsts to override what would be best for the future. So God first, or primary reality is primary. Seventh generation, allowing the future to judge what we do in the present. Consequence capture, that is, allowing it is insane, it's crazy, it's actually evil to allow individuals and corporations to get wealthy in ways that harm the larger body of life or in ways that destroy the future. This is crazy. This is insane. So God first, the primary reality is primary. Seventh generation, that is, the future judges the present. Consequence capture, that is, that we can't allow individuals or groups of individuals to benefit in a way that harms the larger body of life or the future. And then finally, limits are sacred, sacred limits, grace limits. There's a limit to how much any species, not just humans, there's a limit to how much any species can take from the bioregion and how much waste it can exude before the systems start breaking down. And so there's nothing more sacred than honoring limits. And again, that's when you re-mythologize religion, you realize that the story, the mythic fall of the story of Adam and Eve, the fall, as they say in the Christian tradition, isn't about our great-great-great-great-grandmother betraying, you know, or eating an apple. It's about us violating the grace limits of reality. So my work mostly is about furthering this idea of ecology is the heart of theology, and human-centeredness is idolatry.
And, you know, it's interesting, you and your wife, Connie, travel around the country. I've seen your little sprinter that has the Darwin symbol and the fish kissing. Your wife characterizes herself as an atheist scientist. You make presentations to all kinds of groups. So how is I find what you're saying, it's kind of like what they say about the Swami. Swami, you're proposing a sane world. You must be crazy. So how is your work being received by the various secular and religious groups you speak to?
Yeah, good question, Steve. Well, again, I want to also say that your humor and use of language, your turns of the phrase, your use of language is just priceless in my experience. So I so value your humor and use of language. And so I just want to acknowledge that.
Okay.
To answer your question, Connie and I, you're right. We've spoken to 2,500 groups, literally from atheists to evangelicals and everything in between. Although I rarely get invited into the most conservative, most fundamentalist, most biblical literalist of settings. It takes a very courageous evangelical minister to invite me into their church in the first place. Usually it's because they want to move their congregation in the direction of embracing evolution and ecology as sacred, as God-given. Mm. But it only happens once every few years. So the vast majority of, about 95% of the settings in which I've spoken in the last 16 years have been in moderate to liberal religious and secular settings. And to answer your question, it's rather fascinating because I can do the same program and have many, many times in totally different settings, and about 90% of the people really enjoy my program. And I know that because for 3 years we used feedback forms. So I handed out these anonymous feedback forms, and I asked people to give me their radically honest feedback, like what worked, what didn't, what was off-putting, and blah, blah, blah. For example, about 9 years ago, I did a program at the United Nations called Evolution and the Global Integrity Crisis. It was sponsored by the Values Caucus of the United Nations, and it was very well received. Well, I sent a link to the audio of that to Michael Shermer at Skeptic Magazine, who's one of the world's leading atheist humanists and the head of the Skeptic Society, publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He loved it, and he said, I want you to come to Caltech and be a distinguished lecturer at Caltech and speak to an audience of about 300 or 400 people, and most of them are going to be humanists and atheists. And I said, great. He said, I want you to do that exact same program. Don't change anything. So I said, cool. So I did. It's up on YouTube. If you just Google Evolution and the Global Integrity Crisis, you'll see that Michael Shermer is introducing me at Caltech to this group. And you can hear that they love my program. Same program, exact same program. 1 week later, 7 days after that, I delivered that exact same program at Michael Beckwith's Agape Spiritual Center, which is a New Age mecca down in Los Angeles. 3 weeks after that, I gave the same program to a group of Catholics at a Roman Catholic church, and then a week after that at an evangelical church. Now, Catholics, evangelicals, atheists, and New Agers, and the United Nations, are five totally different audiences. And yet the exact same program, without changing a single slide, worked for at least 90% of all of them. And I think it's because what we focus on, what Connie and I have been focusing on for the last 16 years, is what we call the sacred side of science. That is where science, inspiration, and sustainability intersect. And only 5 years ago, actually the last time I saw you and your wife, we were still on what I would call the myth of perpetual progress. That is, we still had a very linear, unidirectional understanding of evolution and of history. So at that time, I had basically the understanding of that human history is from the caves to now, to the stars. I had a Star Trek vision of the future. And the last 5 years, my worldview has shifted dramatically. I now have a much more cyclical, much more, as Barbara Marsh Hubbard talks about, a spiral understanding of evolution and of history. And I'm very present. I've studied massively for the last 5 years, the rise and fall of civilizations. And we are clearly in the declining decades of the American Empire and the declining decades and century or two of industrialism. And what's possible in expanding economies when we're drawing on carrying capacity surplus and we have more energy and resources than we need for the population is very different than what's possible in a contracting economy when we're in declining resources, when we're in climate chaos. And so part of my role now is to help people be present to what's real without just going into depression or despair, but basically staying present, going through whatever stages of grief they need to go through, because that's normal and natural and healthy. But then ultimately coming to what Joanna Macy, one of my great mentors, calls active hope. That is inspired action locally.
Well, you know, this is really where we're going to be going in this next segment, and really talking about how we weave together this vision. Because I think one of the problems is that the current leadership or misleadership of our country, they have a coherent vision. It's a toxic and backward vision, but there's a group of people who believe it fervently and coherently. And exactly. What has to happen is perhaps a new theology that encompasses both the original meaning of religion, religare, which means to bind us to the web of life and bind us to existence. It's a way of relating our individual lives to this greater cosmology. And Western civilization lacks a coherent cosmology. We have people who believe the universe, that the Earth is 6,000 years old, and there are those who, you know, recognize the Big Bang, et cetera, et cetera. So we have some work to do in creating the kind of coherence that we need to have. And I certainly appreciate your the coherence of your presentation and the heartening news that the same presentation can be presented to very diverse audiences. And I think because of the fundamental truth at the center of it, that's why people get it. So we're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, both Michaels will have the mic, and we're going to talk about where we go from here. Wiki Politiki, we're talking about spiritual climate change.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with Michael Mielke and Michael Dowd to talk about how we actually make this shift. We change the momentum, we shift the context. How does the ideal become the real deal? Let's begin with you, Michael Mielke. How do we actually awaken this impulse in the philanthropy, which you like to point out, philanthropy means love of humankind. How do we do it?
So let me try to climb on top of what you said and what Reverend Reality, what Michael Dowd said, and connect it all together and get to an action step. Use action steps. You said it first, Steve. You said what we need is remission, and you put it in terms of remissioning based on what's so rather than what we want to wish to be so. Michael made very clear that historically religion and culture together explains what we should do and what's right and wrong. It's a moral question. Michael makes very clear that the situation we're in right now is a moral, not only a moral hazard, but a moral shortcoming. Because what we are looking at through our virtual reality are things that we could do or might do or should do. And in all the things you read about, you know, whether it's renewables or whether it's driving less or eating less meat, you know, all these things are nice things to do and what we should do, what we could do, what we might do. But in each and every case, when you read them and look at them, it's not enough, not nearly enough, and we're not doing it. So the problem is, how do we remission, the way you've said it, Steve, under the moral reality of doing what we must do for survival? Because that is what moral questions have always answered for us within cultures. Here's what you should do, what you need to do if you're going to survive. So remissioning is doing what is necessary for survival. And we know that that can't be done individually. Individual actions make no difference. So it's not individual lifestyle changing. That's not going to affect anything whatsoever. It's doing collectively what's necessary. So we know what's necessary. We know what we need to do. It's out there. We've heard it from thousands of people. Paul Hawken may be the latest, best answer. But how do we do these things? We've got to do them collectively. That's one thing that we know. And we've got to get help. So here's where philanthropy comes in. Philanthropy funds what it is that we need to do. And philanthropy is funding, as we discussed before, things that will not get us there, not even close, not even in the ballpark. So first, what we need to do, those of us who understand we're not doing what we should do, we're not doing what we could do, is to call on philanthropy to warn us. We're not in a situation now where we've got 10 or 20 or 30 years to begin to figure out to get it right. We're in an emergency. The remissioning has to start with an understanding that gigantic, transformational, necessary change has got to happen now. Not when it's nice, not when we feel like it, not when it's happy for us to do, not when it's convenient, but it's got to happen now. And it's not a matter of what nice, it's a matter of survival. So those of us who get it need to call on philanthropy to say, first, sound the alarm, warn us, get people to understand we're not in a normal situation, we've gone past normal, we must act now, it's an emergency. That's number one. Philanthropy obviously has the scientists, the staff, the people, the resources, the understanding, the data. They're doing, you know, they're connected with the World Scientific Organization and the world data gatherers. They have the staff and the people that know what we need to do. So once they warn, once they alert, once they sound the alarm, then they say, here's what we need to do, and they fund it. They fund hundreds of millions of dollars now but they're funding hundreds of millions of dollars of ineffectiveness. We need to step it up. They admit that, more funding, but to do what we need to do. First, warn all of us. We've got to see we need to change. And secondly, what is the change that needs to happen? That's how we remission. Change is necessary, and doing what we need through help collectively from philanthropy.
Okay, well, Michael Dowd, how do you piggyback onto that, and how do you see your mission of speaking to churches and secular groups? You've said that your mission has changed in the past couple of years. Say more about that and how this can all work together to create a mission and vision that people go, yeah, that's what we're for. It's not gloom and doom. It actually is an opening door and a shining light.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Steve. So, yes, December 3rd, 2012, to be exact, I woke up in the morning and I read an article called, I think it was in The Atlantic, I was online, and it was titled, Five Climate Charts That Should Have You Really, Really Scared. And there was a chart and a paragraph, and a chart and a paragraph, and so on. And I read all five charts and all five paragraphs, and at the very end, there was a TED talk, TEDx talk by David Roberts called Climate Change is Simple. And the writer of the article said, this TEDx talk actually covers almost everything that these climate charts talk about, and we highly recommend it. So I watched the TEDx talk, 14, 15 minutes. I was in tears. I woke Connie up. This was 6:30 in the morning. I woke Connie up, my wife. I said, Don, we got to watch something together. We both watched it. We were both in tears. That afternoon, we bought Bill McKibben's Earth, James Hansen's Storms of My Grandchildren, Al Gore's The Future, and about a half a dozen other books. And basically, climate change went from being back burner to very urgent front burner issue. Then in January of 2015, we discovered William R. Catton Jr.'s book, Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change. And Thomas Berry had been my main mentor for decades, Joanna Macy as well. But William Catton now is just as significant a mentor as they are, because that book, I feel, is the most important book I've ever read in my life. It's the most important book of the 20th century. Many of us feel, many environmentalists and sustainability-oriented people feel that discern that William Catton's book, Overshoot, is the most important book they've ever read, or the most important book in their lifetime. And when I first encountered Michael Mielke and Gene Arnold, his partner, his mission partner, I found in the two of them, they're the heart and soul behind the Association for the Tree of Life, mission colleagues, because there was a sense of urgency, of timing, of necessity, of the role that religion could play. And I just want everybody that's listening to this conversation to, at the very least, read the 1,000-word summary of their essential ebook. The ebook, as you've described, is the title is Delusions and Contradictions, but the really the larger title is Climate and Ecological Delusions and Contradictions That Will Rapidly End Humanity Unless ... So that's the larger ebook. It's about 100 pages. Climate and Ecological Delusions and Contradictions That Will Rapidly End Humanity Unless ... But there's a 1,000-word summary of it up on Resilience, and MAHB at Stanford also published it, and it's simply titled, We Are All in the Clutches of the Delusion Dragon. We are all in the clutches of the delusion dragon. And it just, this little 1,000-word piece so powerfully and prophetically, and again, I use the word prophetic not as a way of talking about what's going to happen in the future or channeling some otherworldly entity, but prophets have always been those who could see what's real, who sensed what was emerging, and then spoke a word of warning that was basically, thus saith the Lord, thus saith the reality. Here's what reality is telling us. And many of our deep sustainability writers and climate writers and activists, such as Bill McKibben, such as James Hansen, such as Al Gore, such as William Catton, William Ophuls, John Michael Greer, Richard Heinberg, these are people who are speaking on behalf of reality and doing so with unflinching authority. And I think nothing is more important than secular and religious people to realize that, A, there are hard times coming down the pike. There are some of these that are now unavoidable. It's not a Pollyanna future. It's not a evolution of consciousness. We're all just getting better and better and easier and wealthier, and isn't it all great? Some of that's true, but unless it also stays present to the degradation of a living world, the species that are going extinct, the toxification of the air, water, and soil, and so on and so forth, unless it stays present to the grief and the sadness and the anger and the compassion that is drawn forth by what reality is telling us through evidence, then we're not going to truly unleash our prophetic power to work together, to call philanthropy to their greatness. Basically, like Andrew Carnegie funded thousands of libraries single-handedly, one philanthropist made a difference in millions of people's lives by creating these libraries. And it's very possible, in fact, it's, I think, inevitable at some point, but hopefully sooner rather than later, that a number of major philanthropists and philanthropy organizations will step up to this prophetic calling for the future, to stand for the future, to be faithful to the future, to fund that which will actually make a difference. And frankly, I think this document that Michael Milkey has created, this Delusions and Contradictions document, and the 1,000-word summary of it, I think points the way in the most prophetic way that I've seen yet available, which is that individuals, when they get reality and when they really get it, like we've been in this Tinkerbell delusion, like if we just believe strong enough that things would get better, they would, that we've been in this delusion long enough that it's time to repent of our human-centeredness, to return to God, that is to life, to return to life-centeredness, ecocentrism, life-centeredness, and measure progress by how well the soil is doing decade by decade, by how well the forests are doing decade by decade, by how well the atmosphere is doing decade by decade, by how well the other species are doing decade by decade. The only sustainable measures of progress, the only thing that will allow our species to avoid extinction, is coming home to reality. It's like the prodigal species. You know, we've squandered our inheritance. We're waking up to our predicament in the pig pen, as it were. And hopefully we're coming home to reality. And it's truly a momentous time. I think humanity, I'm a short-term pessimist, but I'm a long-term optimist. I think we've got enormous challenges and much sadness and grieving to do in the coming decades and even probably century or two. But when I look out beyond the next century or two, I think our species will likely survive. Could be easily another million or 2 million years before an asteroid or a supervolcano or something takes us out. And I think that the history of humanity, when our species is finally done, 2 or 3 million years ago, or years from now, I think the history of our species will be the first 98% of our species we lived in right relationship to God, to reality. And then for 1 or 2% of our species, we were idolatrous, we were human-centered. And then for the last 97, 98% of our species, we came back to living in right relationship to primary reality. That includes the soil, the forest, the water, the life upon which we depend. It's a humble rather than a hubris relationship to primary reality. And I think what we do in the next 10 years is going to make a difference between purgatory and hell. I don't think we can avoid purgatory, to use a religious metaphor, but I think we can avoid hell. And I think Michael Milkey's piece is probably the most helpful roadmap out of hell that I've seen yet.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Michael Dowd. Michael Milkey, do you have any... We've got another couple of minutes left. Any final words what I would like to do kind of at the end is to have perhaps a new mission statement, so to speak, for our species. We never really had a mission statement. We've been just individuals, kind of single-cell organisms in competition, and until very recently, we're able to do that, but now we have to evolve into something different. So first Michael Milkey and then Michael Dowd, how do we codify this new mission for our species?
You know, what you posed, Steve, I think brings us around the circle. I mean, you know, we're in trouble. We need to remission.
We need to remission based on what is real. The Reverend Reality, Michael Dowd, has said that. And that remissioning based on reality means we need to do things quite differently. Now, there is only one entity that we can appeal to help us, guide us, broadcast what best practice is, suggest what to do, feedback after we do it. And that's, you know, that's philanthropy. That is the mechanism, that is the funding entity for the efforts to save us ecologically and in terms of climate. But what you've said, you know, what you've said is, what is that remissioning statement? We need a new mission statement. And I mean, I can't off the top of my head say what that is, but I certainly am going to give it some serious thought. I'll discuss it with Michael. And we can send it in to WikiPolitiki. We can send it in to you, and you could consider publishing it after we've come to it. But what we know from here, I think that's clear, is first, we've got to recognize that the current mission we're on means disaster. As Michael Dowd has said, it's purgatory or ending, and we want to not go to hell.
Okay.
The only thing I'd add to that is that I think our mission is to be Christians. It has nothing to do with beliefs. It's being saviors of the future and redeemers of humanity.
That sounds good enough for me. Thank you, Michael and Michael. It's been really a full hour. I know lots of people are going to be listening to this and listening to it again. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. Go to my website, WikiPolitiki, to find out how to contact Michael Mielke and Michael Dowd and how to get a copy of the little 1,000-word summary of the delusions and contradictions. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki.